All right, this is Roger Early Pryor with another of the Imagining Philadelphia's Energy Futures interviews. I'm here with Adam Garber. Today is August 7th, 2017. We are at 1429 Walnut Street. And Adam, would you mind spelling your last name?
Garber, G-A-R-B as in boy, E-R.
Great. Adam, when were you born?
I was born in 1983 in Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta.
Piedmont Hospital.
Huh. Had your family lived around Atlanta for a while?
Yeah, I'm a third generation Atlantan. My parents were both born and raised there. And my grandparents all moved to Atlanta, at the early 20th century with their families from different places.
Why?
There's actually a really large Jewish community in Atlanta. So part of it, I think, was that. Atlanta actually is one of the larger Jewish communities outside of New York City, and has forever, and I don't really know why that is. It seems weird.
Right.
So I think they moved there partially because of the Jewish community, and then just sort of a weird set of different, I think, reasons. Like my dad's father, his dad was a wandering, eyeglass maker, optician.
Huh.
So I had like a wagon that went town to town, and they lived in Atlanta. And then he grew up actually in the Jewish orphanage home there. His mom had tuberculosis. His dad passed away.
Hmm.
My grandma on that side, moved from like Norfolk. My other grandma moved from North Dakota.
Wow, all over.
And like my grandfather, my mom's side, moved from New York, from Brooklyn.
Huh.
So sort of all over. But they all actually came from Poland-Russia area, sort of along the border, basically. It sort of never knew each other, but they're all basically from the Poland-Russia area.
Interesting. And were they all part of that wave of immigration from the 1880s kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. They were all part of sort of the Jewish immigration. I don't know, there's not a lot of family history, but I'm guessing because of pogroms and other things like that, you know, they sort of left. But before the World Wars, before World War II, I think some after World War I, some before, mostly before World War I.
What are your parents' names?
Marianne and Stephen.
How did Marianne and Stephen meet?
That is a good question. See, now this is going to really stump me. I'm in trouble. They met in grad school. They work in sort of similar fields, both dealing with kids, educational needs. My dad's a psychologist. My mom's an education consultant. They both had their PhDs. I think they met at some party or something originally. There's some story about my dad's roommate saying my dad wasn't going to ask her out, he was. Some like funny story about that. And they were at, this is I think in grad school. My dad was in grad school at Georgia State. He went to undergrad actually at University of Pennsylvania.
Oh.
And my mom went to Washington University undergrad, and then she was a teacher afterwards. And then eventually got her PhD.
And they were both down getting their degrees at Georgia State.
My dad was, and I guess my mom wasn't. Maybe she was a teacher at the time. She actually went back to school after my dad got his PhD.
She's like, it's my turn.
Yeah. After she helped, helped him. His back went out at some point, and so she ended up typing most of his thesis during dictation in the old days. So it definitely was her turn.
That's awesome. Do you have other siblings?
Yeah, I have three sisters. A little bit like Goldilocks, I have an older sister who lives in New Jersey. I have a twin sister who lives in Brooklyn, and I have a little sister who still lives in Atlanta.
You have a twin sister?
Yeah.
Wow. So, so you were born into that mix. So it was the older sister, you and your sister twins, and then the youngest.
Yeah, so there's about, my older sister's 7 years older than me, my little sister's 9 years younger than me.
Wow.
So it's a pretty big spread.
Yeah, 11 years older and 9 younger. All right. Did you grow up in Atlanta?
Yeah, I grew up. I lived there, till I went to college, and mostly, in the summers through college.
Huh. Tell me about, what are some of your memories of growing up?
Memories of growing up.
You and your sister always in the same room? Were you guys putting matching outfits all the time?
It wasn't that bad. I remember when we moved into the new house, we lived in the same house since I was about 2. And I clearly remember the day we no longer were in the same bedroom. We were in the new house, and my room was ready for me to move into, and they moved me out, and I was very upset. because I couldn't share a room with my sister anymore.
At 2 years old, you remember this?
Yeah. I mean, some memory slash probably been told the story 50,000 times. So I probably, yeah, probably the scientist would say, you don't really remember that. You just heard the story too many times. Yeah, so I remember that. I mean, and then we all lived in one house. So we lived there since, my parents still live there. So we've always lived in, basically since we were two in the wow. same house. We actually all had our own bedrooms. This is a pretty, like upper middle class neighborhood. It's, inside the perimeter in Atlanta. It's technically not part of the city anymore. It's seceded. It's called Sandy Springs.
It's seceded.
Yeah, it's very bitter. Mm-hmm. Fight. It's a neighborhood within the perimeter, but sort of on the outer edges, so it feels like suburbia almost, or what you would think of suburbia for Philadelphia. So very, like, green, lots of woods, yards. It's not a McMansion. It's like an old, it was originally a farmhouse actually.
Oh, wow.
And then was converted into this sort of modern house in the, and you know, there's probably like 20 houses on our block, I think, or something.
Wow.
And then, but it's pretty wooded, pretty spread out, not walkable. I do remember though, as a kid always, we used to walk, there's a park about probably a mile and a half, 2 miles away. And as a kid, we'd walk to the park, Chastain. We'd get ice cream at the park and wander around the park. It was sort of weird because there was, and I think we wouldn't do it anymore because there's no sidewalk. It's pretty hilly. And these days people go flying down the streets. So now I wonder, like, why would we be allowed to do that? And why was that ever safe? But we used to walk to the park from, like, the house about 2 miles.
Now, when you say we, so what are your sister's names?
My sisters are Ariel's my twin, Amy's my older sister, and Aubrey's my little sister. So
wow.
All A's.
Yeah. And Auburn, did you say?
Aubrey.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, when you say we used to walk, was that you and Ariel or Amy involved in that too? Or
it was mostly like me and Ariel and either our parents or we had a housekeeper, Darge, who's been with us since I was also one and a half.
Did she help raise you?
Yep.
What's her name?
Doris.
Doris, awesome.
And she helped raise us and still with us. And she, usually my parents or Dars would walk down during, you know, like after you got home from like pre-K or on the weekend she wasn't around, so that would be mom and dad. But, you know, we'd walk to the park and get ice cream and whatever else.
Yeah. That sounds like a pretty idyllic, bucolic kind of childhood.
It was. I mean, I think I was pretty lucky and pretty blessed. And it's, when you think about childhood, it's sort of notable. I grew up, my grandfather, Papa Al, was, as I said earlier, he grew up in an orphanage, Jewish orphan home. And he was very successful and a very successful businessman. And I think sort of would talk a lot about, like, what it was like growing up. But then we had this very different experience, obviously, of, like, everything, you know, just totally anything you needed, basically, which I feel blessed to have had, but was very different than a lot of people.
Was your grandfather like, we used to walk 20 ways uphill, both, you know, that sort of stuff?
A little bit of that, more just like, you know, trying anything to remind us that, you know, we were lucky, and he was really lucky, actually. I mean, he got a fake scholarship to college, essentially.
What does that mean?
He got an athletic scholarship to college. He was not an athlete. The headmaster of the school he went to knew he wouldn't be able to afford to go to Georgia State and had an athletic scholarship he could just give out and gave it to him so he could go. And he turned into a very successful accountant and businessman and owned a lot of stuff in Atlanta. I think did accounting for the entire Jewish community, as far as I can tell. But it was like this lucky thing. And so he'd often talk about, like, you know, both what it was like and then, the, you know, there are just these things that happened that would have probably been, ended up maybe very differently.
Mm. It sounds to me like the Jewish community was a strong part of your experience growing up.
We'd go to synagogue every Saturday. We were always extremely involved in the synagogue. Go to Saturday school, there were twice weekly after school classes, so Mondays and Wednesdays, I think, maybe, or Tuesdays and Thursdays, twice a week.
That's
Hebrew
a lot
lessons.
Of time, yeah.
Yeah. So like twice a week you'd go, three times a week essentially, you'd go to synagogue services, which there were like kids' services and lessons on Saturday, and then like twice a week you'd mostly go in the afternoons. We didn't go to, I went to a Protestant private school.
For high school?
For middle school, high school, elementary school.
Oh, wow. Why?
It is a very good school, and the public schools in Atlanta are not very good. Hmm. And I think my parents wanted us to have a very good education, and so we all went to different... Well, my sister and I started there, and then Ariel went to a different school for high school. And then my older sister and my little sister also went to different private schools. My little sister went to a Jewish day school, and my older sister went to another private school called Woodward. Yeah, I think just, like, the schools weren't very good at the mm-hmm. time. And really, where we lived, they weren't the best. They're better, actually, now. Mm-hmm. But then we'd go to Jewish school.
Why did you and your Ariel go to different high schools?
She wanted to go to a different high school.
Just different experience?
Yeah, Westminster is, it's a preparatory school, and it's a little, I think it's different now from what I know, but it's a little bit of a pressure cooker, it's like a little, like, very focused on the, you know, like, instead of those things that you sort of know about those private schools, I don't know how to describe it, that I think, that and a set of other things sort of, at some point, she was looking for something different. So she ended up going to the American International School and had a really great time there.
Did you enjoy being at Westminster? Was that a place where you thrived?
It was a mixed bag. It was like a mixed bag. I had a set of really close friends, and I'm still close with a set of them today. And I had a set of activities I did, like debate. I was on the debate team. And there were some really great teachers there, but it was also a real challenge at times. Because of the nature of the school, and at times because it was a Christian school, I had some really bad experiences over the years.
You mean like being oppressed for being Jewish?
Yeah. There's like two memories that stick out. One is in middle school, there was a rabbi teaching a math class, Rabbi Eaglitz. Anyway, he was teaching a math class, and a bunch of the teachers, technically you had to be Christian to teach at the school, which doesn't really have anything to do with math, and a bunch of the parents got really upset about it, and they got him, I think, fired, and then a bunch of other parents revolted over it, including my own, and said, look, you know, this doesn't have to do with religion, he's teaching math, he's not teaching his New Testament, Old Testament, whatever. So that was really rough.
What came from that?
They mostly stopped enforcing the policy, I think, around, like, the teachers being Christian unless they were related to the course. So there's a ninth grade, maybe it was, you took an Old Testament course, mm-hmm. ninth or tenth grade, and then 12th grade, you took a New Testament course. And I think those turned out really well. I had really good teachers for them. I had a teacher who taught Hebrew, for the Old Testament course.
Cool.
And that made it really easy because I already knew it. And then there was the New Testament teacher was actually a former reverend, but he was like very open, and we had a very mixed class of folks who were born-agains. We had a Wiccan, we had an atheist, we had some Jews, we had, I think, a Hindu. It was like a weird, like, somehow just fell together, and he was very open to thinking of the New Testament as like a literary document, so that worked out pretty well. Mm-hmm. But my junior year, I think it was, there was a Christian Emphasis Week. There's yearly Christian Emphasis Weeks, and they decided to change it to Religious Emphasis Week for the year to try to be more ecumenical. And the first speaker was from Emory University. She's the chaplain at Emory, so pretty well known in the area, you know, pretty good religious school at Emory. And she talked about universalism and being accepting of other people. And, you know, during the Q&A period, this guy who ran the like Christian fellowship on campus got up and started spouting like John 3:14 or whatever, and you know, all this stuff about if you don't take in Jesus Christ you're going to hell, basically. And she literally left the stage in tears. I mean, they were really harsh to her. And then when we were going, you had a like hour afterwards, you could go to study hall or you could go to a study group, and the same guy who I knew, he came and he said, you know, Adam.
To you.
Yeah, he saw me as we were going into one of the buildings, and he said, you should come to my study group, you can be saved, otherwise you're going to go to hell. And I said something like, you know, if I said something like, Jesus is Jewish, so at least I'll be in hell with him. And then I went to a different study group with my friend who was also an Orthodox Jew, actually, which was a pretty good one. But it was like, you know, but that day, actually, like a third of the people in my class told me I was going to hell.
Wow.
Basically, like, nicely told me I was going to hell. And I've known many of these people since I was like 10, 8, 9. And it was sort of this like astounding moment. Like, you've grown up with me. Why would you just, you know? And they're like, it's nothing about you. It's just, you're Jewish. So that was a shocking moment, I think, you know.
How did you internalize those things as a child? Or as a young man at that point?
How did I internalize those things? I mean, I think the thing I ended up really appreciating was there's just this small cluster of people who didn't think that way, adults and sort of this ideal that there are like these fundamentalists in the world that have like this really extreme view, but that a large chunk I think don't. And then I probably still haven't totally understood like why did people who I grew up with since I was 8 or 9 suddenly think, and like on this day, why not just like say I don't want to be hang out with you or whatever. But to be honest, this stuff happened in Georgia sort of regularly, so it's sort of interesting, and I don't know if it's that different. But
it happened to you in Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, in different ways. Like, you always knew you were a little bit as a Jew in the South, like a little bit of an outcast. So, like, my best friend, Jamie, we went with his Christian, he was in a Christian group, and we went to play Capture the Flag one weekend at, like, some camp in the middle of nowhere. And it was a Capture the Flag, and I was like, oh yeah, that seems like fun, whatever. And it's not, you know, it's the Christian group, but it's just going to be Capture the Flag overnight, camping out and whatever. So that seems fun. So we got in trouble for playing Capture the Flag too loud. And so we ended up having like a fire and hanging out. And then they were all born agains, and or a bunch of them were, and they found out I wasn't Christian. And they spent like 3 hours trying to convert me, which my friend Jamie found hilarious because like we've been friends forever and he's not like that and whatever. But he just sort of thought it was hilarious to watch. You know, so that like you sort of feel like, okay, suddenly it's like a big deal. Or like grew up, I heard stories of my grandfather growing up. There was a Jewish country club called the Standard Club, but there were 3 well-known Christian country clubs. And my grandfather in the business community was asked to go play poker. I mean, these are, like, the stories you hear. So, like, was asked to go play poker at the Peachtree Club, which was Christian only. And he said, well, I can't go in. It's Christian only. He said, oh, it's okay. One of his friends said, oh, it's okay. You can come in the back door. And so, you know, like, you grow up in this thing of, like, it's not, I think it's not as overt as racism can be in the same way. Because it's not as obvious, right? And it's not, maybe it's not as bad as it is today. There's this weird thing where there are moments where you sort of knew, oh, I'm not quite like everyone else. Mm-hmm. I do am kind of different, and there will always be this thing, and, you know, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
So.
I guess I keep thinking, like, what does that mean for you? Was that something you then relied more internally on your family? You and your family grew closer, or you just kind of knew who you,
I think
you knew who you could know and could love you that way?
I think I looked for people that didn't think that way. So, you know, including Jews who I think sometimes can, you know, sort of be very insular at times in the Jewish community and people that sort of were just sometimes less religious or more just like open and didn't care that much about it. I don't have a ton of really close Jewish friends. But at the same time, I think my Judaism's become pretty important to me. So like my wife and I don't have kids, but we've said sort of when we have kids, they will go to synagogue, they will be raised Jewish. She's not Jewish, but that's fine. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's become, being Jewish is therefore like part of your identity. And in some ways, Judaism is partially religion and partially identity. And mm-hmm. so it's a little different than I think Christianity is in some ways. But
yeah. Has the religious aspect been something that was important to you then? Or is that something that's grown since?
It comes and goes. It's like in, sort of comes and goes.
At when?
I don't know. Like in college, like when everyone else would go partying on Friday nights, I went to synagogue for like 3 years straight.
Why?
Partially, I found a really great synagogue I really liked in Annapolis where I went to school. And partially, I just think it was, I was looking for something a little different from the school. There weren't a lot of Jews at the school, small school. And there wasn't a lot of Jewish connection. So I think it just was like, oh, I need some still connection to my Jewish community. But I don't go to synagogue regularly here, so, you know, on the same time.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly what makes it comes and go.
Yeah. Can you talk to me a little bit about what it's like growing up as a twin, and as you're growing up into becoming a man, and a sense of who you are as a self, as an individual, and yet you have this twin sister who you've shared so much of your life with. Is that something that was challenging? Was that a benefit? What was it like being a twin?
Well, I think when you have a twin who's fraternal, it's probably more like just having another sibling. Mm. At least for us, I think it was. So we didn't, we weren't that close growing up. We got along fine, but we weren't like close. We didn't do the same things. We didn't have the same friends. We didn't hang out that much. It wasn't really till like after college probably that we got closer.
Really?
And so I think, there weren't a lot of times, you know, we had to do like we did a b'nai mitzvah together, and we're sort
What's it called when you
have a b'nai mitzvah? Huh. Is when you have, when you have a boy and a girl together.
Yeah.
It's just the plural.
I've never heard of it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And we, you know, so there were things like that, but I think on a like daily, weekly, I don't know, yearly basis, I don't really remember thinking of it different than having, you know,
Just another sister,
you know. And I think probably also some of that may relate to the fact that we were pretty financially stable and blessed. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of tension around like, oh, she got this thing or, you know, whatever, right? You didn't have that stuff happen. Mm-hmm. But we're pretty close now. She's got a little girl. Mm-hmm. So I'm going up in a few weeks for the baby naming. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's also a new little, you're a new uncle.
Zadie, yes, I'm a new uncle, second time being an uncle. I have twin, my older sister has twins,
we're
about five, so.
Wow, yeah, it runs in the family, doesn't it?
Oh God, let's hope not.
You mentioned that your debate team was something you were involved in. Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience was for you?
I got involved in middle school with the debate team, and I continued through high school with it. There were probably about 10 to 12 of us, and actually became pretty nationally competitive. So did a lot of traveling to national tournaments for it, which was really interesting. Spent the summers like going to camp for it and meeting people. So it sort of became a big part of like the equivalent of, I don't know, a sports thing or something.
Yeah.
So pretty close friends from it. And then, you know, it's, yeah, it was like, I really enjoyed it in the moment, and I learned a lot from it. You know, you're like reading a lot of history and philosophy, and I think, you know, sort of, I like to read, so it really like worked for me in that way. And then there's like, in retrospect, there's like weird things about debate that like the way it works, that's like a little bit of like the artifice of just making an argument versus actually believing the thing, just sort of different than what I do today. So it's like, you know, a little interesting to think about in reverse of like, oh, you're just trying to make an argument whether you really think it holds merit or not. Just make the best argument you can versus, which I think I realized at some point in college, I wasn't on the debate team anymore, that like, oh, there's this weird thing happening. It's not about what you believe. It's just that argument. And so that, I think in the end, I sort of made me realize like I didn't want to do something like that. Like I didn't want to become a lawyer who's just trying to make the argument or something like that,
I think. Tell me, and the work that you do today,
yeah.
Tell me about how you see that work.
I mean, mostly I see it as like, it is not a work or not a job. Like, it is what I believe. So I work for an environmental nonprofit in Philadelphia, Penn Environment, and I've worked here for about 10 years. I think of it as like part of who you are. So I think of like, it is like, okay. I mean, mostly that I tell people, like when I talk to our members or something, as I tell them, like, I'm blessed because I get to do something I believe every day, and I get to get paid for it and make a living out of it. That seems like the best of all worlds, right? And so it's like fighting for what you believe in, and luckily you get to make a career out of it. So beyond that, like, what else could you ask for in the world?
That's a pretty great thing.
Yeah.
But debate team at the time was, it seems like a social
community. Yeah, it was a social community. It was an educational community. So probably the first time I ever read, like, Heidegger and Kant, which I read in college. I studied philosophy. You know, a lot of reading of the news, so reading current events, which I do today, obviously, thinking about how the political system works, which I did a lot of in college, and obviously do now in my daily job in a nonprofit advocacy world. So I think probably in the end, probably gave me a lot of initial exposure to those different things that then became things I delved into deeper as time went on.
So you went to a preparatory school in Atlanta, and it was clearly preparing you to go to college.
That
was,
it
sounds like an assumed thing with two parents with PhDs.
Yeah. Yes, you better go to college at that point. I think that's true.
Yes. So where were you thinking in high school? Where were you thinking you wanted to go? What kind of school were you interested in?
Yeah, I was trying to find a school that was actually basically the opposite of Westminster. So something that wasn't about preparing you for the next step in life. What I found was I really loved learning. I really loved like investigating things and diving in deeper. And I didn't really care always what the purpose was, right? So like Westminster, it was all like a purpose, right? Get good grades, learn the things you need to know so you can go to a good college, you can get a good job, so you can do whatever. And then I really didn't like that thing. But what I did like was I loved learning. So I loved studying and I loved reading and I loved all that stuff. And so looking for a school that was like sort of the opposite. So I looked at a lot of small liberal arts schools with sort of alternative, sometimes systems. So I looked at Hampshire College, which is it's create your own major school. I think in Boston, Massachusetts, somewhere. Hamilton, which is a little more traditional, but in upstate New York. And then I ended up looking at this place called St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. Which is based on the Great Books program. So it's all based on reading the great books of the Western world, from Plato and Aristotle to Heidegger and Kant, and in all the subjects. So whether it's philosophy or in biology, starting with Galen and moving through Harvey, you sort of name it. Physics, read the Principia, performed, did all the proofs in the Principia, sort of all that stuff. And so went to this, to have a conversation. We did like a big trip as a family, right? So it was me, my mom, my dad, and my sister, right? So we picked a bunch of schools in Boston, in the Washington, D.C., basically, area.
Yeah. Did your sister have different ideas of what she wanted from college? You sound like you were very clear on what you wanted.
I think she did. She was looking for like a bigger school, a little bit medium-sized. She was looking, I think, for a place that had a bunch of different options. She didn't really know, I think, what she was looking for in some ways. She ended up changing majors a bunch of times, which worked out well first, as she did architecture and art history and something else. So she went to University of Washington in St. Louis.
Oh, where your mom went.
Yeah, this is the case may be. And she really loved it. She had a great time. She met her husband there. She had a wonderful, amazing time. And I think, worked really well for her. But I think looking for something with more of those options, but not like a massive state school or something, and not,
So you went on this family trip to go explore the Eastern Coast schools.
Yeah, we sort of did it as like, let's just go explore 20 different schools, not even the schools you're going to really look at, but 20 different schools with different things, right? So small schools, big schools. So we did like UMass, and we did, American and George Washington and let's go look at a bunch of different types of schools to help you figure out. I think was smart of my parents of like, then you'll know what you're looking for and what you like and you don't like, and then we can look across the country to figure out, what sort of things, right? So I thought that was really smart of them. And we went to this school, St. John's, which I think my guidance counselor recommended. I think Mr. Boggs recommended it. We met the the admissions guy, and we sat and we started talking and talking about the school. And we like literally almost met, like I was so fascinated and in love with the school, and my dad was so fascinated and in love with the school, I think he wanted to go. And we almost missed our flight home. And I got home, and it turned out that I just had to go. And so it was rolling admissions. I went a few weeks later for like a prospective weekend. I remember going to the restroom at 3 a.m. and I walked out of the room, and at 3 a.m. and there are these two guys who I met years later, Augustine and Micah, and they were sitting in the hallway at like, 2, 3 a.m. arguing what happens if you get rid of Euclid's book 5, proposition 4, whatever it was, and what happens to the whole scheme. I can't remember what it was now. I was like, oh, these people are just arguing about math theory at like 2 a.m. in a hallway. And that's what they think is fun. That seems awesome.
Those are your people.
Those are my people, right? And so I went home. I wrote 20 pages of essays in 2 weeks. It was very intensive essay writing. Sent it off. Got in October. And I was accepted. And I was like, I'm going. And that was that. And awesome. Senior year was easy.
You knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So tell me about that experience in college. Was it what you imagined it was going to be?
It was. And it was totally what I imagined it to be, is people having deep discussions and debates about all sorts of, you know, basically about the liberal arts, math, science, philosophy, literature, classics, right, you name it, and thinking through together, you know, how you know, what those mean about the world. And also it was learning how to think. So it was like, we had to learn ancient Greek in 6 months. You do that, everything else is easy. We had to figure out how, you know, we read Einstein. We had to figure out, redo his proofs. And he likes to skip a lot of steps, unfortunately, for everyone. So you figure out Einstein, you're like, okay, I got it. So it was all that thing. And then the thing that was sort of interesting about it was, I wasn't political at all. And I got a... And the one thing it wasn't is it wasn't a political school. And actually, there was like a strain of like, don't be involved in the world while you're in college, which is really unusual for college, right? That's a lot of times people get politicized.
Yeah.
And I ended up getting a job canvassing my first summer in college in Georgia for Georgia Perg on air quality issues. And I became politicized. And I got sort of over the following 3 years, as I continued to do political work and advocacy on environmental and other issues on the side, you know, with some groups at school and on the side, I got more and more frustrated because it was like, sort of like, don't do this while you're at school. So that was the one thing. And I would have never thought that going in. And it was this other experience that just totally like changed it a little bit. So I still love the school and I really like, so glad I went. And then there's just this one piece that was really missing for me.
So you began that to work with George Perg on air quality issues, your freshman, summer of your freshman year. As your schooling continued, the rest of your years of undergrad, was that something that was like kind of angsty? Was that something that was like you were pushing for something different from the way the school worked?
Well,
or was summertime was the time to be politicized?
I did some stuff at school, and there were some angsty, for lack, I don't know if angsty, but I'm not the angsty person, but you know, moments. So I did some environmental organizing on campus, and I did a ton of anti-war organizing. So this was in the lead up to the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm. And what years were you in college?
So I was at school from 2001 to 2005. Mm-hmm. And so this was lead up to the Iraq War, was like my sophomore really year. And maybe beginning of junior year is when we went to war, I guess, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. I just had to find other avenues for it mostly. And then every once in a while when it came to campus, so like when I tried to do some petitioning on campus or something, there was something that happens that felt a little like, oh, these people don't get me or something. Like, mm-hmm. So in that sense, I remember petitioning and someone telling me that Kant's categorical imperative meant they couldn't sign my petition about recycling. It's like, what are you talking about? It's a recycling petition, you know? But it's like, just like sort of pretentious-y, like, oh, we're just going to think about the world answer. But mostly then I just did it. I did more in the summer for sure. And then when I was on campus, I did like some of it, but I did usually through off-campus mechanisms or things like that.
Hmm. In what ways? What was the things you did?
So I was pretty involved. So after the canvas, I was involved with a group called Free the Planet that did a bunch of work on college campuses around getting corporations to clean up their environmental policies by pressuring them. So I did some work with that, and then I did a ton on anti-war stuff. There's a bunch of anti-war groups. There's an anti-war group on campus, and then I got involved with the Maryland Anti-War Coalition, whatever the statewide student coalition was against the war, and did a bunch of marches and organized a bunch of protests. And I had a good friend who was also pretty politically involved, so we did a bunch of marches and rallies and protests sophomore, junior year together.
Would you go down to D.C.? You were so close.
Yeah, we'd go to D.C. for the protests. We'd bring like a carload of people or two. We'd like, you know, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So enough to like have that outlet at least, even if it wasn't like a full-time thing. Like you might find it like another bigger school or school that was a little more political.
Hmm. That's some of the things that stood out to me as you were talking about your college experience was thinking through things together. And is that something you still, it seems like that was important to you in debate team in high school, it was important to you in college. Is that still something that resonates with you now?
Yeah, I think on all this stuff, it's like whether it's the theory, like trying to figure out Kant, or if it's like the politics today, like they're big problems, they're complicated, and I don't think one person can solve them or like figure out the solution or the best way forward. So I think like having sort of the argument of different people and coming to some joint resolution is important. And listening to people, and then hopefully the best concept either percolates to the top, or if you can't totally figure it out, let's figure it out together. And a lot of the stuff in school was like, you know, doing that all as a team, because you'd sort of like the other thing to know about St. John's is the professors don't really know. So the professors have to teach all the subjects. So like my freshman year, Mr. Smith, he got his PhD in Montaigne, but he was teaching our lab course, which was mostly biology freshman year. He knows nothing about biology. So, you know, like, but he had to figure his way through it. And so it's sort of this just collaborative learning. And yeah, he knows a little bit more because he preps ahead of time. But like, of just like, there's not necessarily, just because you're like the teacher or you're whatever, doesn't mean you know more than everyone else necessarily, or you have the right answer. But it's about that like intellectual process.
Something else that struck me is the GA perg work data that summer happened to be on air quality issues.
Yeah.
Was that the spark for your environmental interests?
It was. So there's a day. So we were working to clean up air quality in Georgia. So Georgia had some of the worst air pollution in the country at the time, old coal-fired power plants that were allowed to put out unlimited amounts of smog-forming pollution under Clean Air Act. There's an effort to force them to clean up. Walking around hot in Georgia, really bad air quality, one day, and Atlanta's very hilly. So I get to the top of this hill, I knock on this woman's door, I start talking to her about air pollution and the power plants and asthma, and I had an asthma attack on her doorstep. And I recovered. I had my inhaler with me, which is not always usual. After I recovered and all, I think it was, you know, at the end of the summer, I mean, there were sort of two things. One, right, was like this just very real realization that this isn't abstract, this is real people, and it's even my own life, and it's me, and I don't have I hadn't had asthma problems since I was like 6 or 7. It must be other people. Mm-hmm. And two, at the end of the summer, the politicians decided to allow these power plants to continue to basically spew unlimited amounts of this air pollution, and I was just like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, everyone I talk to wants clean air, right? Like, that doesn't really, like, it should just be everyone. There's not a lot of opposition, you know, from the public. So why are our politicians doing this thing? And so that really was my, like, two pieces that sort of politicized me, of, like, a real visceral experience with the health impacts and this really visceral experience with the politics and the politicians sort of ignoring it, especially in a place like Georgia. And so I ended up running the Atlanta, Georgia campus office the following summer. And then when I graduated, I went to work for New Jersey PERC for a few years in New Jersey on clean energy policy.
So after going to St. John's in Maryland, is that what brought you to the Northeast?
It's like a job, yeah. I was trying to stay in the Mid-Atlantic because I knew I liked it. I didn't want to go somewhere really hot in the South, and I didn't want to go somewhere really cold in the North.
New Jersey fit the bill.
Yeah, and mostly, therefore, New Jersey fit the bill. And I stayed in New Jersey for 2 years, and I like New Jersey. It's a nice state.
Yeah. So after running the Georgia canvassing office, office for PERG, what were you doing specifically in New Jersey?
So I was doing two things. I worked on our energy policy for New Jersey PERG. So my first year, I mostly helped pass the state's renewable electricity standard to get 20% clean energy by 2020. Mm. So it's back in 2005, 2006. And so I helped pass that law. I helped build the support for it, working with businesses, media, labor unions. So I did a bunch of that. And then I helped actually like do a bunch of the policy research around it so that it was the strongest regulation possible. So both sort of the politics and the substance of the policy. So we passed that in early 2006.
That's a huge victory.
It was. It was a big deal.
I mean, today, New Jersey is like the third most solarized state in the Union, part because of that legislation.
I know. Yeah. That was my first policy victory. I mean, that was really my first thing. And like, when I got there, like, everyone, you know, it's New Jersey. They're pretty environmentally friendly. But it wasn't, like, a priority for the governors. I did all this work trying to get it, like, up the priority list by working with coalition partners and using the media to highlight the benefits. And we were able to give it on Governor Corzine at the Times agenda. And that was you're right. It's like everyone talks about New Jersey today. And sometimes I tell them, like, I actually helped, like, basically draft that law, which is really cool, when I was 22.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So then I worked on a bunch of... Then after that, I worked on a mixture of things. Nothing is successful. Energy efficiency policy, and then closing Oyster Creek Nuclear Power Plant, which just finally announced it was going to close, so that took a while. Those were my two other big, like, policy areas that I worked on, and some other, like, random, like, ratepayer stuff. I mean, there's other stuff. And then in the summer times, I ran Canvas offices in North Jersey and in Central Jersey.
So it was a full-time job with CalPERS. It wasn't just, like, in the summertime canvassing. It was...
No, yeah, it was full year. We run a... so they run a two-year fellowship to train future organizers and advocates. And so it's like a mentorship program with a set of classroom-style trainings with a class of about 20 to 30 people, as well as like a mentor where you're doing the work side-by-side, doing the advocacy and the organizing work.
That sounds amazing. Yeah. Tell me about building those coalitions with business and labor unions and writing the policy to help get that passed. What was that experience?
It was a little bit like getting thrown into the deep end. So, you know, you get like this classroom training and whatever, and maybe you think you can conquer the world. So,
when you say that, do you mean from college or do you mean New Jersey PERG gave you
classes? Yeah. So we did like big national classroom style trainings. Mm. So we do like 2 weeks of training. It's a mixture of overviews and briefings and practice. And then, you know, as you're doing the work, you're working side by side with your staff director who acts as like a mentor. But like, it's still like, you're still like the youngest person in the room because you're like 22, right? And all these people have been doing this for like 20 years, right? And they're like, what the fuck do you know?
Yeah.
And, sorry, I don't know. I'm just... you know, and they're, you know, and I didn't have like an engineering degree, I had a philosophy degree, so really, what the hell do I know? there's like a few memories that stick out in my mind. So I've been there for about 2 weeks. And we were going to this meeting, this presentation meeting for the, like, labor council, I think, for North or Central Jersey. So all the labor leaders. And we're in the car, and my boss, Dina, turns to me, and she goes, oh, yeah, and are you ready to present at this thing that we're going to? I was like, I thought you were presenting about this thing. She's like, no, you're speaking, and then we're going to pass around the sheet for, like, coalition signups on the bill. And I was like, okay, so we get, so we practice and prep in the car for 30 minutes and whatever. So we get there. And we're like talking, I think it was to Rick, is the guy's name, and he was like, okay, so the order is, I'm gonna kick us off, then you're gonna speak, then the governor's gonna speak. I'm like, wait, what? So literally, like, this is like 2 weeks in, it's me, it's the mayor of Edison, New Jersey, who introduced, you know, the governor, and then the governor. And like, wow. You know, but it was this moment, and like a bunch of the labor leaders totally signed on and whatever, and then like working with the clean energy businesses, you know, and like...
Do you remember what you said? Were you so nervous?
I mean, I'm sure I said something fine.
Yeah.
You know, and they're sort of all friends. It's Jersey, and they know Dina really well. And so I'm sure it was a little bit like, I'm sure it was not very good. You know, it's like 3 minutes, but, you know, I'm sure, whatever. So, you know, it's like this totally, like, thrown in the deep end and then hopefully having some success.
And you did.
Yeah, did. And then working with a bunch of the clean energy companies and, you know, I'm still friends with a lot of those folks today. I don't know, Pam, she runs like an electric vehicle nonprofit now in New Jersey. And, you know, they're, you know, so that was like the organizing side. My first press conference, I remember telling Dina she had to stay in the hallway. She couldn't come in for it.
Why?
Because it was nerve wracking. You don't want your boss standing there as you're speaking in front of the cameras for the first time. Like, that's crazy. You know, she listened from the hallway. She's very nice. I don't do that for my staff. They get to have me stand right there. You know, standing by, like, these labor leaders and clean energy business owners and elected officials, that was probably, like, month two. And then on the policy side, you know, working, I mean, I didn't know a lot, so I had to read a lot, and then talking through it a lot. It was sort of this group learning thing of, like, talking through it with Dina, of, like, and the rest of the experts at our team, of, like, what are the ramifications, and then we had really close ties. It was a regulation, so it wasn't legislation, and we had close ties to the regulators, so working with them and being in meetings with them, and mostly a lot of that was like, yeah, piping up, but then also observing. And then I sort of remember one of the things we focused on was what's known as the alternative compliance payment. So if you don't meet the, you know, so the way the standard works is a utility company has to get a certain amount of energy from clean sources. The way they prove that is by showing they have a certain amount of renewable energy credits. If they don't meet that, they can also pay something called the alternative compliance payment, which then goes into money to encourage more clean energy growth. And the problem is that if the compliance payment is too low, that it creates a low market for the RECs, which hurts the payback period for clean energy solutions, because it's cheaper for the companies just to buy these alternative compliance payments.
So in the first testimony on one of the public hearings, this was one of the real thing that needed to get fixed because it was set at like, I think like $100 or something.
So any fossil fuel company just go ahead and pay that and not invest in
clean energy, right? And it goes back to clean energy, but it's not as good as like actually getting them, especially from like the health benefit side and the pollution reduction side. And so we really honed in on this idea that the alternative compliance payment needed to be $300, which we thought was like high enough that basically there's no way the RECs would ever reach it and it would make more sense. And so in the first public testimony, I helped organize the public hearing, like organize a lot of people. It was an official public hearing to go to it. Got a lot of the businesses and labor unions to speak, and I signed up, of course, to speak first, so I spoke. And, you know, it's sort of like, here's the big vision and why we need this, and then here's the policy thing you have to fix. And after I sat down, this guy, Eric Stiles, who got up at New Jersey Audubon, and he said, ditto what Adam said. And then the guy at Sierra Club, Jeff Tittle, got up and said, ditto what Adam said. And then, you know, whatever. And so I went, and it's like, oh, they all just trusted that I knew the policy thing well enough and I'd moved them along enough. And so it sort of also taught me this thing that all the things I learned about, like, I can figure out the policy piece if I spend enough time on it, was true, which was pretty comforting because it's sort of what I think I got out of school more than anything else. And I think actually what people should get out of school more than anything else, I think more and more people don't use their degrees in their day-to-day job most of the time. So getting this ability, where did I put that water? Getting the ability to just learn things and be able to figure things out on your own is really just valuable. And then I had that experience, of course.
Those are pretty powerful moments. Yeah. So maybe you can take a quick break here before we transition into how you came to Philadelphia.
Sure.
And then what your visions are for the city.
That sounds great.
Great. All right, let's continue here. So how did you end up, you were working in New Jersey for the New Jersey PERG, doing all this amazing work, getting policies written and passed, and then other advocacy work around environmental issues. What eventually brought you to Philadelphia and when?
Yeah, really the job. So it was a 2-year sort of program, and I could have probably stayed on in New Jersey with them, but I was ready to leave the state. I never really thought about it until I was there, but I didn't like living in a place where I had to drive everywhere, basically.
Where were you in New Jersey?
I lived a few places. I lived in Trenton. Don't recommend it. I lived in like downtown Trenton, though. Don't recommend it. I lived in New Brunswick, and I lived in Montclair. In the northern part of the state. But, you know, you can, like, I was smart enough to find places where I could walk or bike a lot, but you also had to just drive a lot, right? And I sort of hadn't really thought about it. And that was, like, when I was growing up, too. So one thing was I wanted to try to move in, live in a big city. And I don't like New York. It's, like, I get a little claustrophobic when there's, like, a little, like, closing in. And then some personal stuff. I had been engaged, and we broke up. And so I was like...
While in New Jersey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This woman I had been dating from college, we got engaged, and then we broke up when we were living together in New Jersey, and it's like, I just need a clean break. And David Mazur, the executive director where I now work at Penn Environment, he had given me a call. We're PERG and our now are all part of this larger network of groups, and so he had given me a call and said, I have a job, and we should come be the field organizer in Philly. Eventually I accepted that job and moved here, and I never really spent much time in Philly. I'd been a few times. My dad went to college here, so I'd heard terrible horror stories about Philly from him. And he thought I was crazy.
I thought you said your dad went to undergrad here.
Yeah.
Oh, to Penn.
Yeah, he went to Penn at Wharton. He was here when Donald Trump was in school at Wharton. Doesn't remember Donald Trump. Got that phone call from the Boston Globe. But Philly used to be really a crappy town. I mean, it was a dangerous, I think, city, and it was really run down. You know, if you go back into the 70s maybe, early 70s, late 60s. Even I think until about 15, 20 years ago, it was sort of, you know, a shell of its former self. And, the week I moved actually to Philadelphia was the week that the Inquirer had Philadelphia plastered across the banner headline.
Wow.
Because we had hit the all-time murder record.
Welcome to the city.
Exactly. So welcome to the city.
What were your emotions about it then?
About that?
About moving to Philly. You have this new job.
I was excited. I mean, I sort of was excited to be in a new place, to be in a big city, you know, from, you know, it's like
in some ways bigger, some ways not, than Atlanta. It's sort of different. But, you know, sort of like this iconic city, you know, everyone knows Philly. And it has more of that downtown feel. I lived in Center City when I first moved here than, like, most of Atlanta does. So it's like, I was really excited about it, I think, overall. And, I mean, I mostly just fell in love with the city. Like, I came to love that, A, I could walk everywhere I wanted to and take public transit, that I could, that it was, like, neighborhoody, so it's, like, big city, everything you want out of a city, right? Big, great, amazing museums and art, you know, great, you know, restaurants and food, you know, everything you sort of think of as a big city, but also, like, not, like, feels like there's, like, these neighborhoods and communities, right? There's smaller communities within communities, which maybe other big cities feel like that, but as far as I can tell, they don't. So I love that about it. It's really, like, it's totally become my home, and I imagine I will probably die here. So, like, you know, I've just come to really love it.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Tell me about the work and that you've been doing in Philadelphia. Was there a steep learning curve to get used to a new place?
It was sort of, it was and it wasn't. Like, the second time around, everything's easier. So, right, like, both because you're a little more confident, you know a little bit more how it works, and, yeah, you're just a little better. So, like, yes, there is, because the politics are totally different, Pennsylvania versus New Jersey, totally different political landscapes. The issues you're working on are totally different, and the organization is sort of a different setup, and so, that was sort of a learning curve, but then, like, I felt like I could just dive right in. So I think when I first got here, did a bunch of work organizing health professionals around air quality regs or climate change, and I sort of had moved away. So in New Jersey, I had done a lot more of, like, some of the lobbying and advocacy work. I really didn't like that. Like, I can do it, but I don't like to schmooze, and the way that that is. And so here I was really a group. I'm supposed to be, like, the field person, so I'm supposed to be about organizing and engaging and educating the public and allies among different partners, and really building that sort of political power was my mission, and so I really enjoyed that and found that I really sort of thrived in that, but, you know, I sort of was just thrown in and dived right on in. I mean, and I think it was easier the second time.
You mentioned different politics.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
You know,
here in Philly.
So Pennsylvania is, like, you know, it's a Rust Belt state in many ways. It's not totally a Rust Belt state, I know. It's purpley. It's got, like, this long fossil fuel history, right? So even among, like, people that should be your allies, there's this sense of, like, we need more coal or natural gas or whatever. Versus New Jersey doesn't have that history, right? There's a chemical industry history, and, like, I went to events at, like, refineries, right? So there is it is, but the politics are, like, across the spectrum. Everyone's pro-environment, you know, for the most part, you know, kind of thing, and, you know, just more sort of in agreement with the issues you're working on.
Not so in Philly or in Pennsylvania.
And, less, you know, there's definitely places, so in Philly and in the Philly suburbs, that's mostly still true. But the vast majority of the rest of the state, I mean, you know, within pockets, of course, it's definitely much more, like, pro-fracked gas, pro-coal. And that controls a lot of what happens in Harrisburg, in the legislature. And so that was sort of, like, what the, you know, if you think of, like, politics as, like, the art of the possible. The possible in Pennsylvania, what might be a good policy here is, like, a crappy policy in New Jersey. And what might be a good policy here, you know, is probably an amazing policy in Georgia. So, you know, it's sort of like understanding, like, how that plays out and then what people care about. And then the second thing is it's just bigger, right? Pennsylvania, much larger, bigger population and bigger geography. And so, like, I spent a lot of, like, probably the first 5 years going to every corner of the state doing organizing. I've probably been to 40 to 45 of the counties, of the 67 counties at this point. Doing work, and, you know, that's very different than New Jersey, which, like, every day, I could return to home. Like, maybe I'd have to drive an hour and a half, but I'd always get back at home, you know, if I wanted to, right? Mm-hmm. Here it's like, oh, I might be 5 hours away.
Yeah. With that, those different circumstances, the fossil fuel history, the bigger size, the broader scope of the population, how has that changed your perspective on some of the issues that you work towards?
I think one thing is sort of trying to understand where people are coming from. So I think, you know, it's easy when everyone's sort of in general agreement to sort of say, okay, we're all headed in the same direction and we may have some disagreements about how we get there. I think here it's much more like there's diverging visions of the future in Pennsylvania, and they're quite different. And well, of course, I think mine's right, and I'm pretty sure it is. You know, I think trying to be able to listen to people and understand where people are coming from is really important so that you can hopefully get them to move over time. And then at the same time, sometimes just saying that, though, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, I'm not gonna, you know, there's a balance between listening and engaging and saying, yeah, that's fine, but you're just wrong and I'm just gonna move past you. You know, like, I'm just gonna ignore that, right? And so I think it's hard because, like, where do you draw that line? Do you go to deep coal country and make your mission to, like, convert those folks to clean energy champs? That's probably, in my mind, a waste of time. But it doesn't mean you totally ignore them, right? And so what that line looks like, I think, is a challenge in a state like Pennsylvania. And that's different, you know, than New Jersey and let alone, like, California or Massachusetts, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in terms of making, if politics is the art of the possible, the art of the possible is about how to find that middle ground and how to make both sides happy?
No, I don't think it's about that. I think that is a pitfall. I think the idea that everyone should be happy or that, you know, that middle ground is always, like, there's a compromise, but there's still bad compromise. There's still, right, like, so it's understanding to me is important to just understand. I think it's just part of what we probably owe each other as humans. To try to understand each other. It doesn't mean I have to sacrifice my principles completely to come to some compromise. And then I think, you know, compromises, like, yeah, there are bad compromises. There are compromises that I think don't move us far enough towards a better world on, like, environmental issues or on any issue. And then there are compromises that do, and we should be supportive even if they don't get us as far. And I think here in Pennsylvania, that finding where that is really hard. And it's hard also because you have also folks, you know, who I totally agree with their beliefs, but who just want to hold a hard line. And I don't think that's going to get us very far. So I think the politics get, for all those reasons, a little more complicated than a state that's one side or the other.
Do you find yourself being at the front lines of negotiating where that line gets drawn in terms of compromise? But also having a constituency that is very strong in their beliefs of what they want. Do you find yourself in between, not only at the front lines of finding the compromise that works for the long-term interests, but also then having to communicate why that compromise is necessary to your more rabid? Or more, rabid is not the right word. More,
I'll never call them rabid.
No, to your more outspoken and heartfelt supporters.
I think, yeah, I think you have to communicate it well. I'd also probably argue that most of the public, or a huge chunk of it, like 40%, agree with the compromise most of the time, right? Like, there's people on either ends, but then and you have to communicate, and a lot of times they're our best supporters, so we have to bring them along or articulate why we had to make these decisions. But I think actually most of the public's, like, usually pretty happy, right? It's like the loudest voices on either side that get upset or for whatever reason, right? So I'm sort of, you know, I sort of think most people are with us on that compromise because most people aren't that radical, right? Like, or even if they are, they sort of get it, right? Like, so, but yes, to your question, yeah, I think part of our job is to, like, articulate why we had to make the agreements we had to make, why we had to make the decisions, and that we're not happy, that we're not done, right? That the vision is still being made, but visions aren't made in one, you know, I always think of it as, like, aren't made in one fell swoop, right? It's, like, these steps along the path. And I think also, you know, I do, in a place like Pennsylvania, and probably if I worked even more in, like, a place that was probably even more politically anti-environment, I probably think part of our job is just to, like, you know, they always say speak truth to power. Part of our job is just to stand up for the people whose lives are being ruined. So sometimes your job is just to, like, be the thorn in the side and say, you know, I don't know, on fracking, like, I think we're sort of in a really, I just don't think it's going to stop. It's hard to see how we get better environmental protections. People's lives are getting ruined. And I just sort of tell people, like, yeah, part of it is, like, I'd rather just stand with people and say that's where I stood 30 years from now. Even if we lose every day.
There's also places where I think you just have to stand for what you believe in, but mm-hmm. sort of different roles you play.
You mentioned visions aren't things that are made in one fell swoop. There are steps along the way. So I think that might be a nice transition point for us to talk about future visions for Philadelphia. To move into that kind of visioning period, I'll ask you a couple abstract questions.
Okay.
What are some of the things that you value most, that you love?
I mean, I think community is particularly important to me. I think, like, whether it's what I love about the city, that there's this sense of community and togetherness and, like, we're in it together, I think that's really important. Or just, like, some of the things we were talking about earlier about, like, growing up in Atlanta. So I think some sense of, like, we're in this together, I think is quite important. I think, you know, I think this ideal that, like, you know, it's like the golden rule. Like, I mean, I just think this idea of, like, we all breathe, you know, part of, like, the reason I think the things of, like, we all breathe the same air and we all drink the same water is so important is this is a place where what you do affects me, right? Your choices affect my life and my choices affect your life. And sort of tied back to community, but it's sort of different of, like, I think, therefore, we owe it to each other to look out for each other, right? And what I want to have happen to me and my family, I want to have happen to you and your family. And that doesn't mean that we all have to have a perfect idyllic life, and it doesn't mean we all have to be millionaires or billionaires or whatever, right? Like, have everything we want, but that there are some basic standards that we owe to each other about how we experience life and how we impact each other's lives that we have to meet, and that I think that our society should just build around. In some ways, it's all about community, I guess. So clearly, I just care about community. I did write my senior thesis in college about community, as the case may be. So those are the things that I think probably, you know, I think the most about. And then, you know, from, like, the vision of the, you know, or whatever, like, I think a lot about the environmental impacts. I mean, I think because of the experiences we talked about earlier around air quality and things like that, I think it, for me, it boils heavily down to environmental impacts, but I also think of it like other pieces. Someone parked in the no parking spot blocking the playground across the street from my house yesterday, and I was sort of annoyed, but I didn't go say anything about it, you know? And so, like, that frustrates me that I didn't go say anything about it. I should have probably, but, you know, so those sort of things. I don't know if that helps.
Is that, in a sense, justice, doing right, or is that about following rules? Is that about other people need that?
It's justice is like, it's not really about, I mean, it is, justice to me becomes this thing of, like, what I think doing right is and what you think doing right is different. And I know I think my version of doing right, maybe it's not in our case, but, like, I think my version of justice is absolute, right? I think this is, the reason community works better for me and that we're all in it together is because it's very easy for me to say, here's what I want my experience to be like, my family's experience, my friends' experience to be in our city. And I want, if I want that for my friends and my community, then you should have it for your friends and your community. And I think it avoids some of the problems with, I think it leads to justice, right? It leads to a just world. But I think when people talk about justice, it comes down to this absolute way that people can't communicate and connect on in a way that they can understand each other. Because it's just easier to be like, this is the right thing. And that probably comes from, like, a, you know, growing up in a household that's religious and Christian South, you know, but it's just hard to communicate. But it's very easy for me to understand what I want my family's experience to be like and what I want yours. And I think what we find is that when there's, what was I listening to the other day? There's some story the other day, about former Vice President Dick Cheney. There's this hypocrisy there, right? Because he was very, or a long time at times, like, supported a lot of anti-LGBTQ policies. But when his daughter came out as, right, lesbian, or when Rob Portman's son came out as gay, it totally changed the picture. How is that? So, like, to me, that was a communal decision. I said, my son, my daughter is going to have this experience now, so I have to support, change my position. And I wish people would just get to that place sooner.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of the things that you fear, things that scare you in life.
Things that scare me in life. I think that actually more and more living in a city, the thing that scares me the most is that I don't feel like I, and I don't think other people feel like they can say something when they see a problem around them.
So I think this all the time, like on the subway, and this, right, I don't know if you remember the story, but like a year ago, I think it was like a year ago, someone was shot on SEPTA because they, do you remember this? They said something to two guys, I think they were like college age or maybe younger, on a subway car who were like harassing someone else. And then they got shot. And I think there's this problem where, I think for a city especially, the concept that I can't just, I get nervous about saying something. I tell my wife, she gets a little road rage. And she always like flicks off people. And I'm like, don't do that. And she's like usually in the right, handling it maybe the wrong way. But like, I just don't know what that other person's gonna do. And so I get more and more, I'm like, I'm sad and I'm probably a little scared by the concept that we can't articulate. I think in a city, like, it's dangerous sometimes to articulate when you think someone in your community is doing something wrong, because you're worried about what the reaction will lead to, whether that's literally getting shot or some financial thing or some whatever, right? That scares me a lot. And then I think the other thing that scares me a lot is that we sort of, on some of this stuff, try to stay hopeful, but every once in a while I think we as humanity are never, like, just too selfish. We're just never going to be able to see the long-term vision. So, like, it's good to talk about the 50-year vision. It's good to talk to a 100-year vision. But are we going to be able to understand that we have to make those decisions for the long-term about what's happening here and now? And I think we've evolved, of course, to just focus on the here and now. And that's, of course, makes sense. If you, you know, if you have an immediate hunger, if you have immediate whatever. But those two things, I think, I don't know, scare me a lot.
Do you see one of the fears you mentioned about not being able to articulate something that you see that you think is wrong? Do you see that? How do you see that relating to the work that you do?
Well, I think it's easy to, you know, when you see something wrong and you're in a position of like advocating for change, it's a little easier because it's like in a to steal a phrase, a safe space, right? You know what the rules of the game are. You sort of know who you're interacting with, and if you're smart about it, you mostly can control all that. I think it's more like a hospitality courtesy thing to say it on a daily basis, to be able to say, you know, hey, you really shouldn't, I don't know, throw that cigarette on the ground, right? Sort of like, we were talking about this with my, so we live across the street from a park and a basketball court, and I went to the community meeting the other week, and they just put up no dog signs, and there's like been a little bit of a kerfuffle over it. And, you know, we were talking about it, and at some point I said, you know, the guy who works at the rec center said, like, but that's my job. I don't want you guys to ever say something to someone because I don't want to be responsible for what happens. And I sort of said, yeah, but at the same time, like, it's our rec center. Like, it's our park. We all live in this neighborhood. And we should be able to just say, hey, you got to pick up your dog shit. Or, hey, there's a no smoking sign right there. Don't smoke because there's kids around. And until we can... But the problem is, that is in a much more uncontrolled atmosphere. And I think it's a mixture of, it's an uncontrolled atmosphere, and we aren't that good at knowing when to call things out, I think, as people, and to do it in a polite, unemotional way, myself included, that it raises the stakes in a different way.
One last abstract question. Yeah. When you think about energy, yeah, what comes to mind?
Mm. Well, mostly I think about power plants. So I think I probably think heavily about like smokestacks and solar panels. I think they're like my two visions, and I think of it as like, you know, think about all the pollution coming out of the smokestacks, and I think about and all the consequences because I've done a lot of, I know a lot about that, and I think a lot about the you know, the solar panels that I see. Like, I was driving back from New Jersey yesterday, and there's solar panels on a farm in Bucks County, Snipes Farm, and you can see them from the highway. I'm like, oh, that's nice. You know, and so I think those are like probably my two images.
All right. Let's move into the visioning piece here, and we'll talk about the first one is Philadelphia in the year 2067, so 50 years into the future.
Sure.
And again, this is your future vision. You can have an arc for your vision that's a story of growth or collapse or some sort of transformation. It could be status quo, it could be utopian, it could be dystopian. It's your vision. What do you see in Philadelphia in 50 years, the year 2067? What is life like? How is energy being used?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I, since I like to be hopeful, despite my depression at times, I think my image would be, you know, that communities as a whole are generating electricity for themselves. So whether that's solar or wind or geothermal or whatever, that there's a sense that, like, we as a neighborhood, as like maybe a block or something, I don't even know, have come together to figure out how do we produce enough electricity to and energy to survive and to be happy. And, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity to bring communities together around that. So, like, putting solar panels on the children's hospital in my neighborhood or, you know, the parking lot. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to do that as a community and think about energy as a locally grown resource rather than this thing that comes from afar. I think there's also a lot of opportunity to think about energy. I think, like, energy we don't really understand because it's just this thing that shows up, right? I flip the light switch and it just comes on. I mean, unless for the, except for the small set of people probably in the city that have, like, had their electricity turned off, right? Which is terrible. Like, I just think people don't think about the consequences of how they use it. And so I'd like to think people have a better sense of that. I don't know exactly how what that would look like.
But in 50 years, the people you hope the people will have that better sense.
Yeah, and I guess then the city would look like, it would look like I was just in Germany. And it's like there's solar panels on almost every roof, right? It's like you, solar panels are the norm, not the exception, right? They're, and probably for the city, that's the best way to go. So they're like the norm. They're what everyone's using. It's like you expect it on a house. If you don't have it for whatever reason, there's community solar that you can tap into to power your home, or community wind, or maybe some wind from mountains somewhere else. But I mean, that is, you know, I think that is the vision I like to see. And then I think, and you know, we think about it in terms of electricity for our homes, but in terms of the rest, I think it's a city that is has a totally different transit system that. You know, I take transit every day and I walk a lot of places. And in some ways, our transit system's great. You can get a set of places. But, like, once you get out of a certain, you know, basically along the two routes and, like, some of the bus routes, it takes forever to get anywhere. And I think the transportation system has to be a place where, like, I think anywhere in the city, from, like, the city, from City Hall, let's say, right? Basically, I should be able to get to anywhere on public transit in half an hour. And there's no real reason in the city. And I should be able to get anywhere in the suburbs within probably less time than half an hour, and, you know, and within 45 minutes or something, you know, or at least to major hubs in the in the suburbs. But it takes longer. I mean, you know, so than that. And I think if you got to the place where from City Hall, maybe not from my home, because I get, like, I can't always have what I want by my home, I could get anywhere in the city by in half an hour, and everyone could get to City Hall in 15 minutes. You could basically get anywhere in a reasonable amount of time.
How are people doing that in 50 years?
In 50 years. I think, it, I mean, I do think it is still public transit. I just think it is like an expanded subway. I mean, I don't, you know, I think it's a mixture of like public transit, like subway system, probably rapid bus transit, to be honest. And then like express trains to the suburbs. I mean, and I think, you know, the center city area is like car free, right? So there's no cars there. You know, maybe some limited car use for people that live in the city. There's ways to do that. But mostly it's all, like, walking everywhere.
How are cars powered at that time? Were these buses, these rapid transit buses?
I think they're all powered by electric. I mean, I think ultimately the place we're going to have to go is that everything is electric powered. That it means we'll have to make some sacrifices, right? You can't, maybe we'll get charging technology figured out one day magically, but I think ultimately, it means, like, you'll have to stop every once in a while and take 20 or 30 minutes somewhere to recharge your car or your bus. And then that comes from solar. I mean, I do think that's, like, the, you know, or wind or what have you. I think that is where we are headed. And, you know, I think for most people on a day-to-day basis, you can do that. And, you know, it requires some pretty big shifts in how we operate. And then I think, ultimately, it's a place where most people don't have a car, right? Like, I think it's a place where, I mean, that's the other thing. If you had a transit system that
let us get everywhere in 30 to 45 minutes within 5-county region, maybe an hour, you know, you wouldn't need a car on a daily basis. And maybe you borrow a car, maybe there's car share, maybe there's something else, maybe there's communal cars, I don't know. But, you know, if we got rid of half the cars in the city, it sure would make everything go better in some ways. And I think, you know, a set of people today in the city already live that, right? Like, a lot of people in the city probably don't use, I know we don't use our car on a week, definitely on a daily basis, we don't probably use it on a weekly basis. We have a car for when we travel further away, a lot for my work, and, you know, sometimes for ease of use to get to Whole Foods or whatever. But my guess is most people in the city don't drive every day.
Okay. What about food? So food is a kind of energy.
Yeah.
What's the food story of Philadelphia? Are people just going to Whole Foods, or is there some sort of change that happens in 50 years?
Well, I think if our population ultimately doesn't totally rebound, you know, the vision would be...
Wait, is the population dropped in your 50-year future?
Ooh, that's a good question.
What did you mean by rebound?
Well, you know, Philly's population drop, and then just rebroke the million mark a few years ago, and I think has not reached its peak again. I don't think we've exceeded the size of the city at its peak. So that's why we have all these vacant lots in part, right? We have a lot of people coming from the suburbs, whatever. It probably depends on how you think, because, like, I think in my vision, more people live in the city, so maybe Philly does get a bigger population, but that's because there's a bigger push to move into cities and then, like, small city. Like, I think, like, the more we move into, like, a big cities and then smaller mid-sized city hubs and less of the suburbia... And I don't think we'll be there in 50 years, I have to say. Like, I think the cities will probably keep growing, but I think the suburban stuff and the other parts won't. It's just too soon. I think we'll be better off, and I think it's already happening, right? We're just seeing more people move into the cities. And
so that, those trends will continue?
I think so. I think they will, because I think at least for our generation, it's what people want. Mm. And I think there's a lot of benefits now. And I think more and more it's where the jobs are going to be. Maybe they'll be in the suburbs, but they'll also be in the cities. And then I think...
For food?
My guess is we will still rely on places like Amazon, apparently, and Whole Foods, and grocery stores. I don't know if we'll ever get to the place where cities are capable of producing enough food to feed themselves. And I don't know if we'll get to a place where in 50 years where there'll be enough community gardens. I'd like to think that there'll be more community gardens, and I'd love to see... I don't know, I think we have enough space, so I think I'd like to see it. I don't know if enough people like gardening anymore. Just to see enough community gardens.
What does Philly look like in terms of its buildings? Is it more vertical, or is it spread out? Are there still old brick buildings around? What do things look like in 50 years?
I think it'll look pretty similar, actually. I think, you know, you'll see more verticalness in the downtown area and maybe spreading out into West Philly and maybe parts of North Philly. I think the rest, what you would see is potential reclamation of abandoned sections. So, I mean, you have to remember, a large chunk of the city is still abandoned. You know, if you go into Point Breeze and if you go up into Northeast Philly, there are tons of abandoned homes. And I think, you know, it's more likely that we reclaim those and they eventually get refurbished.
Into new buildings.
Or just, like, fixed up as homes, and mm-hmm. not, like, rebuilt completely, then that we go completely vertical in neighborhoods outside of, like, West Philly and old, you know, outside of, like, University City, the great, I don't know, the ever-expanding University City, mm-hmm. and Old City, you know, well, and Center City, you know, then I just don't think the skyline will expand that much further out. Mm-hmm. And then I think in, like, yeah, in Center City, you might see more tall buildings and more verticalness as, you know, a bunch of the homes sort of get torn down, and that makes sense. But I think it will be contained within, like, that sort of region mm-hmm. of the city.
Let's take a step forward into about 123 years into the future. That's the year 2140. So in about 125 years, how has Philly changed? Has it grown? Is it shrunk? At this point, there are some expectations for climate impacts beginning to really be even more of a a daily impediment or a challenge to life than it is now.
Yeah, I think you'll see, like, the Delaware move in some, so then you'll see an abandonment somewhere by 125 years. I think knowing humanity, we will fight the good fight against these rising sea levels.
Do you think there'll be seawalls that help tidal rivers?
I think there will be, and I think they'll probably eventually fail unless we figure out much quicker than we are how to deal with climate change. I mean, we'll fight the good fight for many years, and we'll sort of come to a realization, and probably by 125 years, that that's a losing battle, and that we can't meet it, our needs as a society while doing it. So then I think in Philly, you'll see some encroachment in the southeastern part of the city, you know, an old city. I think there'll be some efforts to save the old part of the city because it's just too iconic. I don't know what that looks like. But I think you'll see the waterways sort of encroach in those areas. There's not a, you know, some of it's not that huge of a population, so you're sort of okay. But I think then beyond that, you'll see then the city sort of expand into the western sides of the city and the northern sides more and more. I think by 125 years out, you'll see, I think the population, I tend to think the population peaked, well, I don't know, at some point in there, the population's going to peak. But I still sort of believe, like, cities are the future, and so I sort of think, like, it will keep growing, and what we'll probably see is, like, some hubs in the suburbs, and then some, hopefully some other cities around the state sort of pop up, so you'll see some other Rust Belt cities, and that will impact us, right? Like, if that happens and they become viable alternatives, there's a little less need of growth in Philly, so it matters to us. I think the city will... But I think the city will keep growing for quite a while. I don't know what it peaks at. And then I think it sort of expands into the suburbs and have, like, additional ideally little, especially if my transition all works out.
I like it. So will Philly experience any of the refugees that are fleeing from the coastal areas?
I think so. I think we will see a lot of growth from that. I think it will happen sooner. So I think, like, probably somewhere between that 50-year and 125-year mark. Somewhere between that 50 and 125-year mark, we'll have some tensions among refugees coming in. Because I think most of the projections, so, like, end of the 21st century, right? And, like, 2090, 2100, right? And so I think a lot of that will happen. There'll be a ton of tension and push. And then by 2145... I think it's where we are, it will sort of have settled out. And I think it will add to the city's population growth quite significantly. Some people will move to the suburbs and other places, but I think some people will just move into the city, and it will sort of settle out.
With the increased heat indexes expected in Philadelphia and with the greater precipitation expected, how is Philly different? Does it look different? Are the buildings different? Are the way people move around different?
I just don't know if we have, like, the wherewithal to really build, like, an underground system of cold caves to, like, keep us cool between, like, I think you'll see some of it, like, I think I could see...
Wait, what is this vision? Like, there would be underground caves to keep
people
cool?
Have you ever, like, in Chicago, like, my sister went to Northwestern and there were underground caves for the wintertime to, like, tunnels between the buildings. Mm-hmm. I don't think we'll get there. I could see it where, like, the buildings become more interconnected. So you can get in and stay in your nice AC and cooler areas. I think we'll see more green roofs on the whole to try and deal with the island heat effect in the city. And I think the real question is, like, do people still play outside and want to go places as much? So I think what will happen is that will still happen, but it will happen in a shorter season, right? Like, in July, no one really wants to walk anywhere, right? It's too hot now. And now, then it will be like, maybe in June and even late May and early September, there'll be like a longer period where the heat is so unbearable, you'll see less people outside unless they have to be.
Does that impact the way that Philadelphia's parks systems work? Are there less parks in Philly? Is Fairmount still a big space? Are the squares still a part of the community sense in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I think it does impact things. I think what you'll, I think the parks will mostly stay. I think they'll get a little bit different use. I think we'll sort of realize that they have other benefits besides places to play. So I think they're still around.
What kind of uses are you picturing?
Well, like things like the fact that they're not like they're heat sinks for the city. So like if you're trying to keep the heat out, right, you want those parks in place and you want green spaces. If you want, you know, good healthy air, you want that stuff. I think you might also see some of them build in like community garden opportunities or farm parks that people could use. I mean, I sort of remember also as a child, like always having a lot of fun at summer camp farming, like with a summer camp and the farm, and I don't know, they got us to do labor for fun. So, you know, I think you can see that happen. I think what you'll see, though, is, like, less play in the summer outside during those hottest days.
How about dealing with the precipitation? Are the buildings or just the way people move around? I mean, you mentioned the interconnected buildings as a way to continue walking. So walking is still a big part of life in 2140.
I think it will be. I think it just won't be as often, but I think it will be. And I think if we can... I just think people in cities will walk.
Do cars still play a role in 2140?
I think mostly not. Like, I think at that point, like, people don't own cars. So you either have, like, the public transit system or, I don't know, some community car share thing, maybe. Like, there are some cars because people need to get to places. But most people won't own their own car. Like, they'll, like, have a car share, they'll rent a car, they'll, like, take a Uber, Lyft, whatever's future. Or maybe cars just become, like, I mean, it's hard to know. Like, it's totally possible with self-driving vehicles that we see, like, you know, everyone gets in their own car, but they're, like, community-owned, right? Like, they're just part of the transit system. Mm-hmm. I think you'll see stuff like that happen. I think people, except for, like, the diehards who love their cars as cars, like, won't own cars. Especially in a city, the traffic will become so unbearable that I think people just won't want to. Mm.
With the energy scene, how is Philly powered in 2140? Do fossil fuels play any role?
If they do, I think we're totally screwed. I think they won't. I mean, I do. I think the question isn't, do fossil fuels end? I think the question is, what's the timeline and how much damage has been done? Right? Like, I think... the writing's on, I mean, not only because they're just running out so they can't exist forever. Like, I think the economic writing's on that wall, and it's just a question of, like, how quickly it goes. So by 2145, I think they're all gone. I think, you know, there may be nukes still. I mean, God forbid, but there may be nukes. There may be something like fusion, if they ever figure it out, which I doubt they will. But, you know, there may, but I think there'll be more, like, solar and wind, and big energy efficiency efforts, you know, and one of the benefits of a city is it is just more efficient. And I think, you know, if we're not going to have the same cheap abundance of energy, people sort of realize the value of it, I think, is part of the problem. We don't realize the value it provides us. And so as people realize that, they'll want to become more efficient. Mm.
Let's move forward to the third visioning piece, which is 2312.
Yeah.
So almost 300 years into the future. As a reference point, 300 years from today in the past is in the 1720s.
Yes.
Right? So North America is mostly Native American at this point. The nations are still very strong. There's a few inroads of colonialism from the Europeans on the coast.
Yeah.
Wood, by far, is the dominant energy source. Coal isn't even on the scene. So let's leap 300 years into the future, almost, and talk about your 2312. What is life in Philly like?
I mean, I think the first question becomes, like, what's our government look like? Like, mm-hmm. I don't even know if we have, like, the U.S. anymore, right? Like, I think at some point, I tend to think by 300 years, something's going to happen. Either we're going to break down into individual state governments or regional governments. It's going to be world government. I don't think that will happen, but who knows?
So at the same time that there is more regional influence in government, there may also be a global structure?
No, I think it's either or. I can't tell which way it's all going to go. I tend to think the one world government thing never happens because people want local control and we're all so different. Mm. So I think that will never happen. So then I think you have, like, more regional things. And then I think, you know, so maybe like Philly and New Jersey become a nice little region together.
But Philly exists. Philly as a city is still there.
I think so. I think there are these things, right? Like, we do sort of know from thousands of years of history. I mean, it sort of matters how much the sea levels rise. Let's be very clear. So maybe it moves in a good bit. But we sort of do know this thing of, like, there are certain places on the globe that have an inherent value that make them thrive. So one of them's always been being on water sources, which Philly still does, right? Another is, I think, unless there's major population shifts in the U.S. in a really weird way, like the population is shifting out west, but it's also shifting south. I think it's like a sort of still centrally located place. And you sort of have to think, actually, over time, in 300 years with climate change, it will get so hot in the south that it will push people back north some. And so I sort of think all those things mean Philly still exists in some function. It's hard to know. I mean, like you said, it's sort of hard to know. It's hard to know if we found aliens finally. So, you know, it's like, it is a little hard to know what the thing looks like, but I think it's sort of like, you know, Rome. Rome's been around for thousands of years, and I think Philly came later, but my guess is there's a set of things about its location that means it will exist in some form or function.
Is it bigger or smaller?
Well, I think in 300 years, the population of Earth is smaller. So I think what we have seen happen, admittedly, is right, as populations become more educated and more knowledgeable and more advanced as economies, right, that population sort of evens out and eventually decreases, right, because you're not having 8 children anymore.
Yeah, demographic transition.
Right, yeah. And I think that's going to happen everywhere. And so I think, one, the population of the Earth will be smaller. I think ultimately some of it is the population of the U.S. will probably, of the United States region, will be larger. And I'm not sure about Philly. And I say that because we just have such big space compared to our population. And so when you ultimately think about like where refugees from Africa, from the Pacific Asian islands are coming from, it's just the best option sometimes. It's going to be the United States. And if we could just get over our hatred of immigrants, I think it just makes a ton of sense, right, from a population density perspective. And so I think in 300 years that will happen. So I don't know what Philly's population will be like. I mean, and it's worth noting, like, the city footprint may move, right? So I think it's sort of interesting. I don't know if there's any good historical studies of, like, cities creeping in location over time. But my guess is there are some cities that have creeped in location over time as sort of like they expand and then they shrink in sort of areas. Or in the next 300 years with climate change, we'll sort of see that. We'll see cities sort of move, right, a little bit. Like a mile or two, which would be enough to deal with a lot of the problems.
Yeah. What's the energy scene like?
Ooh.
300 years.
No fossil fuels, though. That's for sure. I don't know what that thing. I mean, it's hard to know, right? Like, 300 years... So do we even know what the energy source is we're going to use, right? Like, are we still, and maybe we are still solar and wind because that's sort of always here, right? But have we discovered, you know, fusion or some way to have some totally, you know, bacteria that creates, right? Like, there's that whole investigation. I think it's really hard to know what energy looks like. I think what it will look like will be relatively clean compared to what we're doing today. That is, that we will have at least learned our climate lesson, and the hard way probably. And so that lesson will force us into something clean, but if we've probably not invented it yet, you know? I just can't imagine we've invented what we're going to be using in 300 years.
What about what Philly looks like as far as buildings and trees and that sort of thing? What do you see?
I bet we will have, in 300 years, I bet it will look different. I bet it will look more, I think there'll be like more, less just building, and more of an interplay between, I think at some point the climate stuff is going to force us to rethink how we build our cities. And I think I think 300 years will be enough time to reshape parts of the cities and reclaim parts as parks and open spaces and, you know, things like that. But it's going to take that much time for us to sort of be beaten down by destruction. You know, it's like sort of this thing of like, I can't imagine we'll learn the lesson the first 5 times. But I think 300 years will have like sort of restructured the city. So it'll be like more like almost like a living thing where there's more green space, there's more fluidity between it. Maybe there's little pockets of like, you know, instead of just having Center City and West Philly, maybe there's more like pockets of like, I don't know, little miniature cities almost within it or something. I don't know.
So the neighborhood sense of Philly has grown into, they're almost
yeah,
little cities.
I think so.
Yeah. What you, community is a very important thing in your world. What is the social life like in 300 years in Philadelphia? Are people living with families all in one building, or is it still individual single family residences?
I think we'll move. Well, in Philly, it's hard, right? Because I still, in 300 years, I guess maybe we won't have the same homes anymore, right? Like, you'd have to tear down a huge chunk of the city to get there. But I guess I do think, like, yeah, we'll move into more, like, these buildings that have a bunch of people in them and a bunch of communal needs in them, right? And I think that would be good and bad, probably. Like, I think they somewhat segregate communities more, right? Like, you can't just, you don't walk out on your street as much. You just, like, I don't know, my little sister sort of lives in one of these in Atlanta, and she just, like, she goes in and out of her building, and half of what she needs is there, and, you know. So I think that will happen at some point, and whether it's the whole city or just a good chunk of it, I think we'll see more of those. They sort of make more sense. Mm-hmm.
300 years in the future, how are people moving around transit-wise?
Well, I think, see, people move out of their... I mean, I think in 300 years, like, if you think about, like, mostly what you transport yourself for, I think if the city changes enough, mostly what you end up needing to transport yourself for is your job. And I think if you take, like, the teleworking thing to the extreme, you start to see people not needing to go anywhere for their job. Now, you need to go sometimes to meet in person, but I think it will become, like, I don't know, holograms or whatever, right? Like, they'll just be, or virtual interfaces, right? I mean, if you just see what's happened, we'll get to this point that at least for a lot of jobs, we won't need to do it. I think we'll be heavily roboticized. I mean, I think, you know, 125 years, we'll be, like, heavily roboticized. So, like, the jobs where you actually have to physically build something will be taken care of heavily by robots that are managed by other people. And so then I think you have to travel less, and then it works well if you have, like, stuff in your community that you don't have to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So then I think the question for the city becomes, like, do those communities actually have some heterogeneity to them that they then, like, represent the whole community? Mm-hmm. But I think you'll see, therefore, less transportation, probably more public transit, or, like, the car thing where no one owns a car or whatever. Maybe personal flying cars. But, like, I think that, you know, if I just think about it, I think, like, that will, those two features will shift over the next 300 years, the need to travel on a daily basis, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I think most of us, we travel to work, and then, you know, every once in a while, once a week to go grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. And even then, it's just, like, you less transportation need.
Yeah. Is there anything else about either your visions of the future or your sense of Philadelphia that you want to share?
I don't think so.
Thank you so much for taking time today.
Of course. This was awesome.